There is a passage in Visuddhimagga, or the path of purification, that I want you to read. That's on the screen. Now, suppose you are reading this book and you do not have any knowledge of Abhidhamma. You do not know anything about Abhidhamma. And you happen to be reading this passage. And imagine how much you can understand, or after reading two lines you want to throw it away. So this passage is the explanation about restraint. Now, he enters upon the way of its restraint. This is the words from the text. And then he explains, he enters upon the way of closing that eye faculty by the door panel of mindfulness. Now, you know eye faculty. Eye faculty means what? Eye sensitivity. Sensitive parts in the eye are called eye faculty. And what the Buddha taught here is to protect the eye faculty, or to restrain the eye faculty. So Visuddhimagga explains what that means. It is the same one. It is the same one of whom it is said he guards the eye faculty. So to guard the eye faculty, or to undertake the restraint of eye faculty. Now herein, there is neither restraint nor non-restraint in the actual eye faculty. So in the eye faculty, there can be no restraint or non-restraint. Restraint means wholesome, kusala. Non-restraint means akusala, unwholesome. But there is no kusala or akusala, no restraint or non-restraint in the eye faculty, since neither mindfulness nor forgetfulness arises in dependence on eye sensitivity. Now, what depends on eye sensitivity? Eye base. What types of consciousness depend on eye base? You just learned it yesterday. Seeing consciousness, right? So seeing consciousness depend on eye sensitivity to arise. So that means there must be something to see, and there must be the eye sensitivity, and then that object must come into the view of the eye, and so on. So how can we restrain the eye sensitivity? There can be no restraint or non-restraint on the eye sensitivity. So neither mindfulness nor forgetfulness. Mindfulness is for wholesome, and forgetfulness is for unwholesome. So since neither mindfulness nor forgetfulness arises in dependence on eye sensitivity, therefore there is no restraint or non-restraint in the eye faculty. On the contrary, when a visible datum as object comes into the eye's focus, so when something comes into the focus of the eye, then afterlife continuum has arisen. Now, before you study Abhidhamma, this word will be very strange to you, life continuum. You don't know what it is. You know the meaning, but you don't really know it, right? Continuum means continuing. And what is life continuing? So now you understand what life continuum means. Bhavanga, right? Okay. So after Bhavanga has arisen twice. Now twice means vibrating and rest. So after these two have arisen and ceased, the functional mind element, now you functional, you understand, kiriya, mind element, manodhatu, accomplishing the function of adverting, avajana. arises and ceases. So if you remember the diagram for seeing thought process, you may be seeing in your mind that moment. 5 sense door adverting, right? So now mind is turning to the object. So the functional mind element means panchadwara vajana. The 5 sense door adverting. 5 sense door adverting is one of the functional rootless consciousness. Okay. So that consciousness arises and ceases, disappears. After that, eye consciousness with the function of seeing arises and ceases. It's not very easy. Once you know the diagram of the thought process. So after turning to the object, then the person sees the object, and so in his mind, eye consciousness arises. And that eye consciousness has the function of seeing. After that, resultant mind element with the function of receiving arises and ceases. You know that. What is the Pali name of that? Sampadichana. So Sampadichana arises and ceases. So Sampadichana is often called resultant mind element in the commentaries. After that, resultant root causeless mind consciousness element. Now you know what that is. Root causeless means ahetuka, right? Rootless. Mind consciousness element means mano vijnana dhatu. That is, it belongs to the group of mano vijnana dhatu. And actually, it is the investigating consciousness. So, with the function of investigating arises and ceases. After that, functional root causeless mind consciousness element, that means manodvara vajana, because it is functional. So functional root causeless ahituka mind consciousness element mano vijnana dhatu, accomplishing the function of determining. So at that moment, there is determination, determining that this is a desirable object or this is undesirable object. So that consciousness arises and ceases. Next to that, impulsion impels. That means jhavana moments arise. You can even add to it, right? 7 moments of jhavanas arise. So next to that, impulsion impels. Herein, there is neither restraint nor non-restraint on the occasion of life continuum. So at the moment of bhavangas, there is no restraint or non-restraint. There is no kusala or akusala, because bhavangas are what? Resultant consciousness, vibhaga. Since they are vibhaga, resultant, there is no restraint kusala or non-restraint akusala during those moments of bhavanga, or on any of the occasions beginning with adverting. So at the moment of adverting also, there is no kusala or akusala, or no restraint or non-restraint, because the adverting is what? Kusala or akusala, or functional or resultant. Functional, right? And at the moment of seeing consciousness is what? Kusala consciousness or akusala consciousness or resultant consciousness or functional consciousness? Resultant consciousness. Since it is resultant consciousness, at the moment of seeing also, there is no restraint or non-restraint. The same with accepting or receiving consciousness and investigating consciousness. And then determining consciousness also, determining consciousness is functional. So there is no kusala or akusala at that moment. But there is non-restraint if unvirtuousness or forgetfulness or unknowing or impatience or idleness arises at that moment of impulsion. That means during the 7 moments of jhavana, if there is unvirtuousness, then there will be non-restraint. If there is unvirtuousness, means breaking the precepts, so it is the opposite of sila. Or forgetfulness, it is the opposite of mindfulness. Or unknowing, opposite of knowing or knowledge. Or impatience, the opposite of patience. Or idleness, that is opposite of effort. So if any one of these arises at the moment of jhavanas, then there is non-restraint. When this happens, it is called non-restraint in the eye faculty. So now you understand the meaning of the phrase non-restraint in the eye faculty. Non-restraint in the eye faculty simply means letting akusala arise through the eye door. That means when you see something, if you do not practice sila or mindfulness or not understanding or patience or effort, then there will be akusala. So trying to avoid akusala regarding the eye or regarding seeing is called restraint in the eye faculty. So you will find the restraint of faculties or protection of faculties when you read books on Buddhism. And restraint of eye faculty does not mean that you are to close your eyes. You may close your eyes, but still you can have akusala, right? So restraint of eye faculty really means avoiding akusala from arising through the eye door or through seeing. Now, if you understand the meaning about eye faculty, and you understand the meaning about ear faculty, and so on. So with regard to the restraint, Buddha taught that a monk, when he sees an object does not take the sign of person, or does not take the particulars of that person, and so on. So the restraint of faculties, now faculties are actually the material properties, the eye, ears, and so on, and also the mind. So restraint of faculties means not letting akusala arise through these sense doors. And in detail, as it is explained here, you can understand that when a person sees something there, or this process of thought moments, and at this moment there is no restraint or non-restraint yet, at this moment also there is no restraint or non-restraint yet, and so on, until you reach the 7 moments of jhavanas. So during those moments, if there is unvirtuousness and so on, there will be non-restraint. And if there is virtue or mindfulness or knowing or patience or effort, then there will be restraint in the eye faculty. So now you think that it is very easy to understand this, but I wish I could have you read this at the beginning of at the beginning of the class, right? And then compare your understanding after the class. So there are places like this in this big book, but many people may have read it or may still be reading this book, but it is very difficult. So it is best read with a friend or with the teacher. But you know, this book is actually a handbook of meditation, and it is written by a monk for monks. So here that there is a footnote, and it says to expect to find in the Tiga. Tiga means the commentary on this book. So to expect to find in the Tiga an exposition of the cognitive series and some explanation of the individual members in addition to what is to be found in the Visuddhimagga itself is to be disappointed. So suppose you do not understand this passage. Normally, if you do not understand a passage, you will go to the commentary and you read the commentary and you will know it. But here he is warning us to expect to find such a thing is to be disappointed. There are only fragmentary treatments, because as I said, it was written by a monk for monks, and so the author took it for granted that his reader monks already know Abhidhamma. That is why you need knowledge of Abhidhamma to read this and to understand it. This book itself teaches Abhidhamma, because there are chapters on aggregates, bases, elements, faculties, four noble truths, and Patichasamubara, the dependent origination. Okay, now I touch upon the word dependent origination. So I must ask you one thing. In the dependent origination, there is one link. Are you familiar with the Pali formula? Avijja paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnana, vijnana paccaya nama rupa. And what do you think of these links? In one link, there are two factors. Avijja paccaya sankhara is called one link, and there are two factors, avijja and sankhara. So what do you think of these links? Are they cause and effect? Or say in the link, vijnana paccaya nama rupa, because there is consciousness as a condition, nama and rupa arise. Now you know nama and rupa, mind and matter arise. So does that mean consciousness produces nama and rupa? Mostly people think that way. The first one is the cause and the second one is effect, and then that second one is cause and the third one is effect, and so on. But that is not so. Some are called cause and effect, but they are not producer and product. They arise together and one supports the other, or they support each other, and they are also mentioned as cause and effect. So this only through Abhidhamma you understand. So without the knowledge of Abhidhamma, the dependent origination cannot be understood. you may understand a little, right? Because you have to know, what ignorance means, what sankharas mean, what consciousness means, and so on. So that is one difficult thing about dependent origination. And the other thing is how these factors are related, in what way they are related, as cause and effect, or as just friends, like friends helping each other, or one helping the other. That you can understand only through Abhidhamma. And Visuddhimagga explained all this. But most people who wrote about dependent origination do not touch upon that aspect of relationship between different factors. They just left that out. As far as I know, the only author who wrote about dependent origination and who touched upon this relationship between different factors in accordance with Pathana was the Venerable Jnana Tiloka, the German monk. That Venerable Jnana Tiloka was the teacher of this, author of this translation, Jnana Moli. So, if you want to understand Paticca-samubbada fully and correctly, first you study Abhidhamma. Now, in the States, many people ask me to teach them Paticca-samubbada, but I told them, until you have studied Abhidhamma, I will not teach you, because you will become disappointed just after one or two talks. So, a knowledge of Abhidhamma is very important, and there are many places that you cannot understand if you do not have the knowledge of Abhidhamma. So this is just one place in this big book. There are many places like this. One thing is asking questions. Now, in the East, we have respect for our teachers, so we do not want to ask questions to our teachers. We think that it is impolite or disrespectful to ask questions, and also we are afraid that teachers might be angry with us when we ask questions. And so in the East, mostly we just listen to what the teacher says and then pick up our books and return. So, but in the Western countries, it is different. So they encourage people to ask questions. They teach children to say why. They ask always why. So if you meet them, treat them the same way. You ask why to them again. But sometimes the whys cannot be answered, right? There can be answer to every question of why. So in the same way, you may ask any question, but I may not be able to give answers to every question you ask. But asking question is said to be one of the causes or reason for the development of Panya. So, in the commentary on the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, and also in other commentaries as well, it is said that there are things that lead to the arising of the knowledge or wisdom. So, here it is said, six things lead to the arising of this enlightenment factor, that means investigation of objects. And investigation of objects simply means understanding or knowledge or wisdom. So six things lead to the arising of knowledge or wisdom. And the first thing is inquiring about the aggregates and so forth. Now, this is very important. If you do not ask, you will not know, unless you can pick up a book and read it. So, asking makes you understand more. So, when you ask, you get an answer, and so you know more. So, inquiring about the aggregates and so forth is one of the six things that lead to the arising or development of wisdom. Inquiring about the aggregate and so forth means seeking the meaning of the aggregates. So what are the aggregates, how many aggregates are there, and what each aggregate represents, and so on. So particulars about the aggregates. And then seeking the meaning of the elements, how many elements are there, and what are these elements, such and so on. And the meaning of sense bases, meaning of faculties, the meaning of powers, enlightenment factors, and path factors, absorption factors, that means jhana factors, samatha meditation, vipassana meditation, and so on. So, asking questions is one of the things that lead to the arising of knowledge or wisdom, and so we should ask questions. But as I said, not every question can be answered, because teachers are not Buddhas. So they may not be able to answer any question, but it is good, because if you get one answer, then it makes you understand something more. So here also, the sponsors are encouraging you to ask questions. And many people I met say, here is Bhante, and ask him any questions you like. Ask him, ask him. They are always referring them to me as though I were a computer that can put out every answer to the question. But I will try my best to answer the questions, and I cannot assure you that I will be able to answer every question. Asking means not just asking the teacher. You can ask among yourselves too. See, there is a group of students, and then you can ask each other also. So this way you can increase your knowledge of the subject. So we have gone through the passage in the Visuddhimagga, and there are many, many more of them in that book, and also in other teachings of the Buddha. So it is good to understand Abhidhamma if you are interested in Theravada Buddhism, because Theravada Buddhism is actually founded on Abhidhamma. If you reject Abhidhamma, you reject Theravada. And as I said before, Abhidhamma is a very popular subject with Burmese monks especially. But there are Burmese lay people also who study Abhidhamma and even teach other people and wrote books. So Abhidhamma has become a very popular subject for Burmese monks, and every monk, every novice, every nun is expected to know Abhidhamma. And we study Abhidhamma the hard way, because I think Myanmar is the only country in the world where these things are studied through traditional methods. We still memorize books, and we still use the textbooks that were written maybe 1,000 years ago. The original of this manual was supposed to be written in the 11th century AD, so it is about 1,000 years old. So we are still using that book as a textbook, and we thinks that this is the best introduction to the Abhidhamma Pitaka. And also, as I said before, we have night lessons for some of the books of Abhidhamma, the first book, the third book, the sixth book, the seventh book. So that also helps Burmese monks to be familiar with Abhidhamma. And I think now you can find out for yourself whether a knowledge of Abhidhamma is helpful or not. I want you to make decisions for yourself and not follow me or not follow any other people. So you are human beings and you are taught to be independent, and the Buddha said, do not take anybody's words just because he happens to be your teacher or just because it accords with your religious books and so on. So Buddha exhorted us to use our own knowledge, to use our own judgment. Going by other people's sayings or statements is surrendering ourselves to that person. Like, we put ourselves under that person's influence and we do not want to use our own judgment or examination, but that is not healthy. So whatever the issue, please try to understand it, and then only when after you understand it you can make judgments. If you do not know the subject, you cannot make judgments on this subject simply because you don't know it. So for me, Abhidhamma has become a very interesting subject, and I didn't intend to teach Abhidhamma in the United States, but circumstances were such that I had to. So I taught an Abhidhamma class there, and then they were recorded on tapes, and these tapes are now distributed to many places. But my original intention was for people in the United States only, and I did not expect to be teaching Abhidhamma in this part of the world simply because there are many Sayadaws or many monks who know Abhidhamma and can teach Abhidhamma very well. Some teachers can teach Abhidhamma better than I can. But I happen to be invited to teach Abhidhamma in this area, so I taught Abhidhamma in the early months of 1999 in Lunas and in Malaysia. I'm glad to help you understand Abhidhamma because it is so essential for the correct understanding of the teachings of the Buddha in the discourses. So with this knowledge of Abhidhamma, I hope you can improve your understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, and also not to let those teachings as just learning level. We try to understand the teachings of the Buddha not just to understand them. Actually, we want to use them. We want to make use of them. We want to follow them. We want to practice them. Now, like medicine, Buddha's teachings are effective only when they are practiced. If we do not practice the teachings of the Buddha, we are like people who have hundreds of bottles of medicine at home and do not take any of them. So this understanding should not stop just at understanding, but it must reach the level of practice. Only when we practice will we get the benefits of the teachings. So we should direct our mind to the practice, and practice and learning should go hand in hand. Not only learning and not only practice. So these two should go hand in hand, and one can help another. A practice can help you to understand the teachings in Abhidhamma more deeply. Now, when you understand through your practice, and your understanding is very sound and stable, your understanding is very good. And when you understand the teachings of Abhidhamma and you practice, then you will know what you are practicing, what you are experiencing when you practice meditation. So these two help each other, and they should go hand in hand. But more important is the practice. Now we say that something is ultimate truth. That will become ultimate truth only when we experience it through our practice. Until we do not experience it through practice, it is not ultimate truth for us. It is just a kind of concept. We just know it through reading books or attending talks. But when we experience it ourselves, then it becomes a real, ultimate reality for us. That is why the ultimate reality is defined as something that we can experience, that we can realize. So we should make this learning or this knowledge of Abhidhamma from books become our own experience by practicing. So through practice of meditation, through using the mind as a powerful tool to understand the teachings in the Abhidhamma, to understand the true nature of three things or true nature of mind and matter, we should strive to make the most of our knowledge of Abhidhamma. So this way our understanding and our practice will be balanced. Not too much learning and not too much practice, and so we follow the middle way here. Okay, thank you.
You heard what Sado say about the merit of asking questions? So, question time. Anybody? Yeah, asking questions is the way to develop wisdom.
Yeah. Sayadaw, just some clarification on the Paccaya-samuppada, dependent origination. We always say depending on one factor arises the others. But you say it's not cause or effect, any effect. Would it be more correct to say one factor is conditioned by the other? Order, please.
In the formula, the word paccaya is used. And the word paccaya can mean both producing condition and just the helping condition. But I think it is better to translate it as conditioning than as cause. So, normally, we are wont to say, because of avijja, there are sankharas and so on. But it is not as good as saying, conditioned by avijja, sankharas arise. Or, because there is avijja as condition, there are sankharas. So, among the links, some links are links between cause and effect, but many are not between cause and effect, but just the helping. Because those that arise at the same time are described as the cause and effect. So it is better to translate it as conditioning than causing. A conditioning can include causing also. So for example, sankharapatya vijnana, say, conditioned by sankharas, vijnana arises. So that is the relationship between cause and effect. Sankharas really produce the consciousness, because the consciousness here means resultant consciousness, and these resultant consciousness are produced by karma, that is called sankhara here. So with regard to dependent origination, it is better to translate conditioning than causing or cause and effect.
Thank you. The other clarification is vinyanang. Does it refer specifically to rebirth consciousness or just consciousness?
That refers to not only to rebirth consciousness, to all resultant consciousness, but many others explain it to mean just rebirth consciousness. So that is not complete, because you go to this book. So there are the consciousness is explained as all 32 types of resultant consciousness. So when we say resultant consciousness, rebirth consciousness is also included. Yeah. And it would be very good after you have a knowledge of Abhidhamma to study dependent origination with the help of Visuddhimagga. I wish I could teach the dependent origination in detail, but maybe one day it's possible.
Next question.
Venerables, I have three questions. In the seven stages of Javana, if the first Javana stage is Akusala, does it imply that subsequent Javana stage will be Akusala? Or does it mean that it is still possible to arise Kusala's Chittas?
No, seven Javanas must be all Kusala or Akusala. There can be no mixture of Kusala and Akusala in one thought process. So in one thought process, if the first javana is akusala, then the other javanas will also be akusala.
My second question. What determines the first javana stage is kusala? Is it because of the determining jitas?
It is actually determined by what is called yoniso manasikara. Yoniso manasikara is translated as wise attention. So wise attention you pay to the objects. So that means correct attitude towards the object. So when you have yoniso manasikara, the javanas will be of kusala kind. But if you have the opposite of yoniso manasikara, which is called ayoniso manasikara, then the javanas will be akusala. So mostly that depends on the attitude, your attitude towards different objects.
Then the last question. In practice, if a person need to exercise restraint or have so-called good or right intention, when does a person need to exercise that during the entire thinking process?
Buddha taught his monks to practice restraint all the time. Because the monks are those who are trying to avoid akusala as much as they can, and so they are exhorted to practice restraint. And restraint of the faculties is one good quality in monks. So restraint of the eye means both keeping our eyes down and not to look at each other like this, and also not to have akusala enter through the eye. Now, you know, monks are trained to look only about 6 feet in front of them. That is when they go in town and villages. So that is one kind of restraint of eye faculty.
Any more questions? Please.
Sayado, if less, because many chittas depends on the heart, hadaya. What happens? Let's say a person goes for heart transplant, would that be any changes to the?
Yeah, that is a problem. You know, we are trying to solve, but we cannot solve it yet. Now, one thing is, when we say heart, we do not mean the whole. A physical heart, but it is said that there is blood in the heart, and what chitta depends on is that blood. So the blood may be going all over the body, not just the physical heart. And this is a controversial point in Abhidhamma. That since Buddha did not expressly say that it is the heart, so it may be something else that many types of consciousness depend on. The cardiac theory of the heart being the seat of consciousness was accepted during the time of the Buddha. And so, although Buddha did not commit himself to saying heart is the seat of consciousness, the commentators, the ancient teachers, deduce that even though Buddha say a certain type of matter, it must be the heart. And they use the method of elimination. So one by one they eliminate the possible things for heart, and at last they say, since others cannot be the heart, this must be the heart, something like that. Now there are even some others who do not accept, or who do not want to accept, that heart is the seat of consciousness, because they are aware that now Science taught that brain is the seat of consciousness. But I don't know science, and so I'm not sure about that. But one thing is, I think we cannot reject it easily. The word heart is used for mind also. This is a usage. This usage comes from the belief that heart is the seat of consciousness. And this usage is both in the teachings of the Buddha as well as, say, outside the teachings of the Buddha. And also, when you are happy, you have some feeling here. Now when you are sad or when you are afraid, and when you are afraid, your heart beats rigorously. So I think heart can also be the seat of consciousness. And the transplant problem is a problem which we cannot satisfactorily solve yet.
Next question.
Is it against the Buddhist religion to eat beef?
To eat
beef.
Beef?
Yeah.
Or to eat meat?
No, particularly beef.
You know, the cattle were used in cultivating, and so people in those days take cattle to be their benefactors, and so it is not correct, say, to kill one's own benefactors to eat them. Although Buddha did not expressly forbid, say, eating beef, I think it is still good to avoid eating beef or eating meat altogether. This is also a point of issue between vegetarians and non-vegetarians. In our country, there are people who avoid eating beef with that understanding that they are our benefactors and so we should not eat meat of these cattle.
Venerable Sir, for laymen, I think it's quite difficult to exercise restraint because I think, we need to interact with people, etc. So, if let's say the akosala consciousness arises, can we use sort of a mental noting to see that the thing arises and then see it dies rather than reacting to it? Will this help, you know, in purifying the akosala consciousness?
To use what?
Basically mental noting that you know, the akosala consciousness as arises and then we don't react to it but just a mental noting until it dies away. Will that help?
That helps, yes. Especially when you practice vipassana meditation, so whatever arises in your mind, you will be mindful of that state or you make mental notes of that. So making mental notes actually is not to get rid of them, but to understand them, to see them as they are.
So, but will this result in a karma, in a bad karma, even though the akusala arises? But we don't react in speech or action, but actually the mind door actually register the arising of the consciousness.
So, when it arises in the mind, that it is akusala. But not every akusala has the same degree of gravity. Now, some akusalas are not so bad as other akusalas, something like that. So sometimes you cannot avoid having akusala. But these akusala may not give you very bad results. Like, say, when you eat, you enjoy eating, right? So when you enjoy eating, then there is akusala, there is an attachment. But that cannot be avoided unless you are a meditator. And even sometimes you are meditating, you may not want to make notes of these small activities involved in eating, and so you may have attachment to food. But I will not say that attachment to food is good or something like that, but it cannot be avoided. And since you know that this is akusala, then you can train yourself not to get too much attached to food, something like that.
Okay, I think there's another question about QT consciousness. I think if, let's say, if our dear loved one is going to pass away, I think we can help them to make their mind stable and not to be agitated and remind them of things. Then how about ourselves as a meditator? Let's say that we at a time when before the QT consciousness is going to set in and we are able to see the karma or karma sign or the sign of destiny. So through our own our cultivation in meditation, can we change the sign of karma? That means thinking of concentration objects or what is the best object? Could it be a Buddha image or just through our concentration of the meditation object? I mean, will it help us to change our destiny and go to a place or rebirth in a place whereby in future we can cultivate, you know, higher?
Yeah, I think we can do that. If you are a experienced meditator, then the bad signs of karma or bad signs of destiny will not appear to you. But if, even if they appear, you can practice mindfulness on seeing them, just seeing, something like that. And also the other thing is, if you are still fully conscious, then you can think of the kusala karma you did in the past, like doing charity, helping other people, making donations, paying respect to the Buddha, and also practicing meditation. So thinking of that, those kusala acts may change the sign of karma or sign of destiny.
But at the point of time, will it be too weak? Yeah. I mean, because I don't know, when you concentrate on an object, it's difficult because your mind will drift. But at a point in time, I don't know, will it be too weak?
If you're too weak, then you will have to depend on other people, say, do the chanting or to talk to you about what kusala acts you did in the past.
Bante, extending on that question, suppose a bad karma sign were to arise and then you change it with a good karma sign. Does that bad karma get exhausted?
No. It doesn't get chance to give results at this moment. But later on, it may give results because we cannot efface, we cannot cancel the akusala karma altogether. Even one has become an arahant, right? One has to suffer the painful consequences of bad karma. Like the Venerable Moggallana, it is said that he killed his own parents in one of his lives, or he did something wrong to his parents by hitting them. And so, even after becoming an arahant, even after becoming the best among those who possess power, he was not able to prevent this from happening to him, and so he had to surrender to this fate. He was clubbed to death by, according to the books, 500 robbers. So akusala karma cannot be cancels or effaced, because it has the nature of giving results, and so this nature cannot be changed. But, or in the story of Angulimala, now he killed many people, more than 1,000 people he killed, and then the Buddha met him and then tamed him, and he became the disciple of the Buddha, and later he became an arahant. So, because he had become an arahant and he has no more rebirth, the akusala karma of killing many people become defunct, simply because there is no more rebirth for him, and so they could not give any painful results to him. So it is like doing crime in this country and then escaping to crossing the border and getting in another country, so the police in from this country cannot do anything to you, something like that. So akusala karma will not be effaced, but its time of giving results may be postponed.
Any more questions, please?
I'd like to know about the collective karma. And also, if in a place many people die at the same time, is it because of this collective karma or something else?
I think when people do one kind of act together, so they are said to be doing collective karma. But actually, it is their individual karma, not actually collective karma. Now, suppose say many people go fishing. Each one of them kills fish, and so that is each one's own karma, and not the collective karma. But there are instances where a karma of one person may affect another person. There are stories of those who are born with bad fate and they were always unlucky, and those who live with them also become unlucky and so on. There are one or two stories of this in the commentaries. And also there is the story of monks killing themselves and also having another person kill them because they became so disgusted with their lives. And the commentaries explain that these monks have done an akusala karma in the past together. So they put poison in a tank where there are many fish and so on. So when they became human beings during the time of the Buddha, Buddha saw that their karma at that time was about to ripen, and even he could not prevent this, and so he said, I want to be secluded for 2 weeks and nobody should approach me or something like that. So when people do karma together, I think that can be called collective karma.
Saido, I've got a couple of questions. First question is, several lessons back you mentioned that some people, out of compassion for animals, use in experiments, these people become violent. Would you say their cause is just? And if it is so, what should they do instead of becoming violent?
The fourth Brahma Vihara, Upekha. We can balance with Upekha. People are angry because, say, these animals are used as experiments. And so their anger may encourage them to act. But when you get angry, or when you become sorry with the victims, let us call them victims, then you are going beyond the boundaries of compassion. First, there is compassion for the animals that are used in the tests. But later, you have anger or ill will or sorrow with them. So what you do is, you do whatever you can, say, to help them or to save them. But if you cannot do any more, then you resign yourself with the understanding that beings have karma as their own property. That means beings suffer or enjoy according to their karma in the past. So now these beings must have done bad karma in the past, and so now they suffer. So by dwelling on the fact that beings have karma as their own property, or it is their karma and I cannot do anything more, you can keep yourself within the boundary of compassion. So the last of the Brahma Vihara, the equanimity or Upekha, is a good factor or good practice to balance between compassion and anger or hate, or sympathetic joy and getting too much happy with the persons that are prosperous and so on.
The second question is related. I think you've already answered some of this second question. Essentially, stray animals in many countries are controlled by culling. How should Buddhists react to this, and what can they do, or what should they do?
Please say it again. In the countries, what?
In many countries, stray animals, because of the their large population, they are controlled by culling or killing them.
That is the usual method used. And how should Buddhists react to this? And what can they do or should they do to try to reduce this killing?
Buddha taught to keep the five precepts. So killing in any form is not acceptable to the teachings of the Buddha. But when other people are killing the animals, we may or may not be able to interfere with them. So again, if you cannot do anything for them, then practice equanimity or upekkha, considering the law of karma.
But a lot of this killing is because of the policies of the authorities. You think the Buddha should speak up to ask the authorities to stop the killing or reduce the killing?
That the Buddhist or any person can do. But whether the authorities will listen to them is another matter.
But should the Buddhists be more active? Because I know a lot of the Buddhist countries, killing is not done. So like in, I think, Myanmar and Sri Lanka and all this, a lot of strays are let alone, they are not killed. And if the Buddhists don't speak up, it's sort of condoning the killing, and would that be contributing, or would that be sort of participating in the killing, although the physical killing is not done by the Buddhists, but by not speaking up, would that be participating in it?
I don't think so, because there are limitations to what we can do. And if we think we are responsible for other people killing, then we will be responsible for everything. People pay taxes to the governments, and these governments, I mean the Western governments, are making nuclear weapons and to kill people and so on. So if we think in this way, then everybody will be responsible for the killings made by the governments. So what we cannot do or what we cannot even influence, I think we should practice the upekkha.
Thank you.
not that we are not compassionate towards them, but sometimes there is a limitation for what we can do.
So please rise and put your palms together.